Thanks, Mark, and thanks to everybody for being here. Hopefully the talk will be useful to students and young postdocs who have not heard that much about group field theory or other related formalism for quantum gravity. Which this statement is also meant to be an apology for the more senior of you who must have heard these things for quite some time now, and nothing I can do about it at this stage. It's a bit too late. Right, so I'm going first of all to motivate the research we are doing, trying to clarify what the general problem of having space, time, and geometry emergent in quantum gravity from your favorite fundamental quantum gravity model is. Then I will introduce the formalism in which I will tackle this problem, discuss the issue of the continuum limit, which is related to the renormalization of these models, and then in the end show you a path for extracting continuum physics out of these models, in particular an emergent and effective cosmological dynamics. So that's the first part, is just introduction and motivation. And I'm not going to discuss all these points, but let me just, the main message here is just that there are several hints even before you enter specific quantum gravity formalism for believing that the usual continuum or smooth notions of space-time and geometry are doomed in quantum gravity, and something different, probably of a discrete nature, has to come up as more fundamental. And the hints come from several corners. The very challenges to define localization in semi-classical GR. Of course, the notorious problem of space-time singularities, which may signal indeed the breakdown of the continuum itself. The very existence of thermodynamical laws for black holes. On the one end, it has been suggested that the solution of the information loss paradox may require some form of non-locality, and one way to have non-localities is if the continuum notion of space-time breaks down. And more generally, Raphael Sorkin, who is not around, has convincingly argued that the very fact that some particular configurations of space-time, which are the black holes, have an entropy, implies that they have a microstructure. And if the entropy is finite, this microstructure should be of some discrete type. And then I would call hints of this type of emergence of space-time also work on derivation of the Anson's equations as an equation of state for some unknown microscopic degrees of freedom, a la Jacobson. And the insights from analog gravity models in condensed matter, where you have an emergent and effective theory of fields moving on curved geometries, starting from microscopic atomic models, where there's no notion of curved geometry, no need to introduce it. None of this is conclusive, of course, especially the last two are really just motivating hints, but they're there nevertheless. More appropriately, it has to be said that in all the approaches I know to quantum gravity, we do end up or start from microscopic degrees of freedom, which are just not smooth fields on space-time, not even a geometry. So main guiding idea is that we are forced to work without space-time at the fundamental level, which, however, implies that space, time, and geometry have to emerge at some effective level from these non-spatiotemporal entities. And this is just to have nice pictures in your in your talk, space-time disappearing or dissolving into more abstract, exotic constituents. And there is, of course, a long history of people speculating in this direction, and it's customary for any talk in theoretical physics that pretends to be serious to have a quote by Einstein. And so this is a quote. But it's not the usual one in which he says, maybe we have to get rid of the space-time continuum. At least it doesn't say only that. The most important part of the quote is the last sentence. Is a realistic guy, and so he says, well, at present, however, such a program looks like an attempt to breathe in empty space. So the other message of the talk is that we are slowly learning to breathe in empty space, and we hope not to die in the process. Okay, space-time has to emerge somehow from non-spatial-temporal discrete building blocks. Why does it look geometric and continuous, and how does it emerge? Well, again, let me put on the table the guiding hypothesis for our work. There's no proof of anything at this stage, once more, but this is what we're following as guiding lines. First of all, if space, time, and geometry have to emerge, we imagine that they're going to be the result of the collective behavior of the microscopic building blocks. It's not that just some of them will start behaving individually as geometry or as geometric degrees of freedom. We expect the collective behavior of them, possibly of many of them, to be well approximated by a notion of a smooth geometry and space-time directions and so on. One further hypothesis is that this collective behavior will lead to different phases for the microscopic system and phase transitions. And that one of such phase transition, at least one, will be indeed interpretable as a transition from a phase where no geometric description is possible, not even at the macroscopic scale, to one in which such geometric description is possible. And to look fancy, we call it geometrogenesis. Then, in particular, is the larger scale dynamics of geometry that we want to look in the most coarse-grained description of the fundamental dynamics of the fundamental degrees of freedom. In other words, we assume, or at least we imagine, that cosmology will have to be found in some appropriately defined hydrodynamics of the microscopic degrees of freedom. And hydrodynamic just in the sense, the very general sense of the very coarse-grained description. Really, we have in mind an analogy of space-time as a sort of a condensed matter system where you have your atoms of space which give rise, maybe through some phase transition like a condensation, to an hydrodynamic regime where you have an emergent geometry and then matter fields and so on, NGR, governing the dynamics of such emergent collective variables. Again, one more nice picture. And this is the emergent space-time, reasonably smooth, still quite simple. But and more nice pictures, so that at least you remember the first 5 minutes of the talk because of the pictures. So just we imagine that just like a gas of atoms at some point condenses and becomes a nice smooth fluid. Well, similarly, we can start imagining that we are going to have our microscopic building blocks of space in our models that the picture is not random. You will see that they have a representation in terms of little simplices, will collectively behave in such a way as to form progressively smoother structures, still with quantum fluctuations, and at the end give rise to your nice, almost boring in this particular example, space-time. So again, this is the summary of the 4 points I've been making. So this is the general conceptual setup that inspires us, and now I tell you how we are supposed to realize it, how we are trying to realize it. The first question is, okay, nice picture. What are these quantum gravity building blocks you've been talking about? This means that they introduce for you a class of models and a formalism. and I have to justify, I have to tell you what the basic ingredients of the formalism are and what are the building blocks suggested in this formalism. So the formalism is group field theories, and the first message, cautionary remark, it's a quantum field theory, it's a class of quantum field theories, but you should not think of them as quantum field theories on some space-time, because they're supposed to be, in the sense I tried to specify earlier, quantum field theory of space-time. The quanta of the fields are what makes up space-time in some approximation, what builds up space-time in some approximation. They do not leave themselves on any space-time. More technically, there are field theories on several copies, d-copies of a group, and I take the complex case in this example. So there is a reasonably well understood classical phase space for each quantum of the fields, which is just the cotangent bundle of the group manifold. And if you know about loop quantum gravity, you realize that this is exactly the classical phase space for the pieces of spin network states associated to the nodes of the networks. So there are several choices in the construction of models. One is, of course, the choice of group, and this is usually chosen in models related to gravity as the local gauge group of gravity, say the Lorentz group or the SU2 subgroup. And D, the number of copies, is chosen because, as you will understand in a second, it gives a first hint of what is the dimension of the space-time you are going to reconstruct, if you're good from these models. So this is the four-dimensional example. Four group elements are the variables of the fields, or you can go to some Fourier space and there are four Lie algebra elements to the four group elements as conjugate variables. So this, as you can see, is a very general framework. It doesn't have a, well, it has an interest in itself mathematically, but the real interest for quantum gravity lies in specific realizations, so in specific models. Still at the general level, if that's the field theory, well, the Hilbert space we are positing for the building blocks of the universe is a Fock space. The symmetrization that is the bosonic statistics at this stage is just an assumption. And indeed, you can relax it, you can construct fermionic models or more exotic possibilities. And the Fock space is built out of single quantum, single body Hilbert spaces, which, given the variables the theory is defined on, is just some L2 space with the R measure, if you are in the compact group case, of D copies of the group. And again, you should realize that this is the Hilbert space of a single node of a spin network before you impose gauge invariants, or of a single tetrahedron in the dual interpretation. Because of bosonic statistics, which again is an assumption, you have some commutation relations of this type. Then, depending on the model and what you want to do with it, you will impose additional conditions on the fields or at the dynamical level, and they will imply restrictions on the Hilbert space. Again, there we enter the realm of model building. So this is the fundamental Hilbert space of the degrees of freedom of the universe, and it is from this quantum degrees of freedom that space-time, geometry, and matter fields should emerge. Of course, you leave room for enlarging this Hilbert space if it turns out that you need to have more type of degrees of freedom. So you construct states out of the Fock vacuum, and a graphical interpretation of the data associated to a single quantum is as a single spin network vertex, or, as I already anticipated, as a single tetrahedron dual to it. And to clarify for the students, we are not as imaginative as really saying that there are little tetrahedra down there, because, you know, the very notion of a tetrahedron requires some embedding, and it's an extended structure, and so it would not really be serious. We're just saying that it makes sense to represent those degrees of freedom as tetrahedra or networks, because the extended structures we construct out of them will keep having this interpretation and will guide the reconstruction of geometry and spacetime. In fact, the generic quantum states will be some arbitrary collection of such tetrahedra or spin network vertices, including states in which you have imposed conditions that glue together the tetrahedra to form pieces of extended triangulations, or you glue together the spin network vertices to form extended spin network graphs. And one thing that I will not expand upon, because, well, one has to make a selection, but you can show that in this formalism, this gluing is just establishing that there is entanglement between the building blocks. This gluing is exactly going from a generic tensor product state to some entangled state. So this connectivity of this discrete space that you're going to define and construct is just entanglement of the microscopic quanta. Okay, so still at the general level, you have a field theory, you write down a dynamics by choosing an action, which in practice means choosing some kernels for the kinetic part, the quadratic part, and kernels for the interactions you have. Here I wrote only one, but there can be many. You have to write down an action, and again, a specific choice of kernels will define for you a model. What is general is the fact that the way you pair, the way you combine in the kernels the group elements or the arguments of the fields in the interaction is peculiar and is combinatorially non-local, in a sense that I will clarify right now. I give you an example. Take the D equal 4 case. You choose to construct a model such that the vertex, the interaction vertex, has a simplicial interpretation. It means the following. It means that you associate, as anticipated, to each field a tetrahedron, or to each quantum of the field, a tetrahedron. And then you choose the combinatorics of the arguments here to mimic the fact that you can glue together tetrahedra to form a four simplex by gluing them across common faces. The fact that there are common faces is encoded in the pairing of arguments here in the interaction. Graphically, you have, for example, five fields, each with four arguments, and you combine them in the interaction kernel, so by identifying the group elements, which are the arguments of the fields, pairwise, just like you need five tetrahedra glued pairwise across faces to form a four simplex. And that's a building block of a discrete space-time triangulation. Okay. Yes.
Does it maybe then also lead to a suppression of this? So if you use these particular geometric interactions, does it lead to a suppression of these common states that are not glued together, but there's no adjacency?
They will receive zero amplitude in the perturbative expansion. Or better, it's not that they get zero amplitude, but only some degrees of freedom in those states will propagate non-trivially. Yes, so that, again, but, yeah, okay. Right, so you write down the quantum theory, and frankly, the I here can be replaced with a minus, because at the moment we don't really study in detail the full path integral. The theory is usually defined, and we understand it better, in perturbative expansion. So you expand in Feynman diagrams, knowing what is the interaction kernel and the propagator of your initial model. What happens is the following, that by construction, the Feynman diagrams are dual to stranded diagrams constructed out of these building blocks and propagators. And by construction, because of the interpretation of the vertices, they are going to be dual to cellular complexes, or in particular, simplicial complexes of arbitrary topology. So the quantum theory gives you a sum over all possible discrete triangulations, spacetimes, weighted by some appropriate amplitude that depends on the model. And also the combinatorics of the complexes depends on the model, because it depends on the argument, pairing of arguments in the interaction kernel. Are you still with me up to here? Yes. Only people that I was indeed expecting to be following confirmed that they were following. This is not encouraging at all. I encourage all the others to not vigorously or make wild signs that they are understanding and they're very happy about what's going on.
Can you explain that to those two lines?
Sorry, wait. First, second.
How do we construct the space-time dimension from this action?
Yes, so if you're referring to the discrete topological dimension of the complexes, is encoded in the combinatorics, is the fact that you can interpret these fields as tetrahedra and the interaction as a four-simplex. You read it out of the combinatorial structure of the interactions. This a priori may not lead to four-dimensional continuum manifolds. So that's a separate story. This is the discrete structures.
Can you explain the point about the time diagrams? Yeah, I'm not sure I understood these two lines. What is stranded diagram and what is the next page?
Yes.
What is a stranded diagram?
Yes. A stranded diagram is an object obtained from gluing these building blocks, which are already stranded diagrams.
What is stranded?
The strands are these lines.
I'm
calling those lines as strands, and the full bundle of strands propagator line.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Stranded, not in the sense of being left alone on a street. if that's what you were worried about, we are not leaving anyone behind. Yeah, I hope. I mean, if you feel left behind, ask questions. Yeah, okay. Thanks for asking. It's the first time I received that question. It's good for some novelty. Okay, anyway, if you know about matrix models, you come from that side of theoretical physics, then you should realize that this is the basic idea of matrix models for two-dimensional gravity extended to higher dimensions. Okay, the other point is that the amplitudes are interesting because generically, although the specific form is model dependent, but generically they can be written as spin form models or as lattice gauge theories, depending on whether you use group variables or the conjugate representation variables obtained after Peter Weyl decomposition. And this is the nicest picture of a triangulation I could find after a quick look on Google. Sorry. Okay, so nice, okay, you gave me your formalism, but we understood that your building blocks are somehow graph vertices or tetrahedra, little simplices. What does this have to do with geometry and gravity? And there are two levels of this question, discrete, which I can already answer now, and continuum, which is what I will go in towards in the rest of the talk. So I tell you what group field theories have to do with other quantum gravity formalism, and in doing so, you should understand what is the connection, at least with discrete gravity, at this very basic level. So I'm not sure where you all come from in terms of things you know and you don't. You must have heard about tensor models yesterday. Well, if you take group field theories and you trivialize, you remove the group theoretic data and you only maintain the combinatorial structures. And one way to do it is, for example, to go from Lie groups to either a finite set with n elements or to finite groups, still labeling your the arguments of your field. You end up with what is basically a tensor over a discrete space for each index of dimension n. So you go from a function of, say, three copies of the Lie group to a tensor, which is n by n by n over a finite set. And from the field theoretic action I wrote earlier, you would go, for example, again, in this d equal 3 and still simplicial case, to a particular contraction of tensors over the repeated indices. But the stranded graphs will still be associated to the Feynman diagrams. The simplicial complex is just as well, with the same association between vertices of interaction and simplicial building blocks. And this is the D equal 3 example, but you generalize. And again, what happens is that you still expand in diagrams that are still related to triangulations. So you still sum over triangulations, but with amplitudes, sorry, I should have called this A, like in the previous slide, which are purely combinatorial. So they depend, of course, on the range of the indices you have for your tensors, but then they depend only on combinatorial information on the graph, like the number of faces, the number of vertices, and so on. Pure combinatorics. If you want, you can reinterpret this amplitude as the exponential of the red reaction for gravity discretized on equilateral triangulations, because you don't have additional information about edge lengths or curvature that is not in the combinatorics. So this is a formula for random tensors, which give rise, in this sense, to random geometries, random discrete geometries. However, most of the combinatorial results of tensor models, which are many and interesting and useful, apply also to group field theories. The reason why we add the group theoretic data is that this makes a nicer contact with geometry, discrete geometry, as I will show in a second, but also just richer models with richer dynamics. So more interesting from that point of view. Indeed, the relation with simplicial geometry has to do with the fact that the specific properties of the GFT fields and action that we choose are usually, in our model building, guided by the requirement that the discrete structures that I've introduced, like the little tetrahedra, are geometry, have a well-defined notion of discrete geometry, edge lengths, areas, volumes, and so on. So there is several ways of doing that. Let me skip that. If you know about spin form models, you will know about all this. The main message is simply that you add to a generic field over four copies of a group additional constraints or conditions that guarantee that the tetrahedron that corresponds combinatorially to it has also a well-defined associated discrete geometry. So you can meaningfully talk about reconstructing the discrete geometry of the tetrahedra, meaning the areas, volumes, edge lengths, and so on, from this group theoretic data. Okay, this is the main point. All the rest is how you actually do it, which implies a restriction, of course, on the Hilbert space of the quantum field theory that you deal with. Okay, so this now becomes, in this geometry-inspired models, the fundamental Hilbert space of the degrees of freedom of your quantum space, of your universe. These geometric building blocks, where again, geometry is in the discrete sense of simplicial geometry. Are you still with me? Bianca? Good. Right, okay, so you add the appropriate geometricity condition to your model so that you can have this interpretation. The rest is the same. Combinatorial structure is not affected. But what happens is now, in models where you impose these conditions, the amplitudes are now really interpretable as spin-form models, as the ones coming from loop quantum gravity considerations, like EPRL, Friedel-Krasnov, whatever you like. And they can equivalently be written as bona fide lattice gravity path integrals, in the sense that they really look like some discrete action for gravity in terms of group elements or Lie algebra elements, discretized on a simplicial manifold, exponentiated path integral. For each Feynman diagram, you're going to have a lattice on which you discretize gravity. But the theory comes with this sum over all lattices to recover the infinity of degrees of freedom that you associate to a rich enough space-time. But the picture is the same. And by the way, you should realize that this also means combining the two main ideas of defining simplicial quantum gravity, Rege calculus on a given triangulation, or dynamical triangulations by summing over randomizing the triangulations. We know a lot about the classical limit at the discrete level, meaning at the level of each of these amplitudes. So we are more or less confident that we are encoding correctly at least the simplicial geometry. Now we need to go beyond. Okay, this is one particular example of such a form of the amplitudes as simplicial path integrals or spin form models or lattice gauge theories equal to each other, just change of variables. And if you come from loop quantum gravity, one way to understand this is that you are reinterpreting and rewriting quantum loop quantum gravity states, that is spin networks, as many body states where the individual quanta are just the quanta of the group field theory. And the gluing is, as I said, basically generated by entangling this quanta. And you can have this correspondence from a sort of a first quantized language to a second quantized Fock language, Fock space language, at the observable level and at the level of the dynamics as well. Okay, so propaganda, but which I want you to keep in mind. That's the purpose of propaganda. Okay, so it's on the record, so I will leave it. Now, let's go to the even more interesting questions. You gave me a quantum field theory, fine. I understood that your candidate building blocks of space are, fine. I understood that to some extent they encode discrete geometry, so discrete gravity, discretized gravity, and they connect nicely, I believe you, with this other formalism, which also are in various ways motivated or related to gravity. Fine, but this is still discrete. Now, 2 points. They are field theories. Are they consistent as quantum field theories? Second, otherwise all this embedding of these ideas and structures into a quantum field theory would be useless if the resulting quantum field theories were not consistent. Second, okay, you gave me the discrete geometry. How do you go about defining the continuum limit? And this becomes basically the issue of group field theory renormalization. In order to clarify what the issue is, you should realize that when we talk about these discrete building blocks, although you understand them as the microscopic UV-like degrees of freedom of geometry, the more fundamental ones, they are not themselves smooth fields, though they don't correspond directly to a smooth metric field or matter field, so you have to recover them. Moreover, if you're changing the type of degrees of freedom from the usual ones, smooth fields on a smooth manifold, there is a new direction that you have to explore, which has to do not with the classical limit as such, given a set of degrees of freedom, but with the increasing number of degrees of freedom. It's independent direction. And I want to stress that, because so the issue at this level is not the semi-classical limit at the discrete level. The issue is the continuum limit. The two limits have no reason to commute, first of all, nor have any reason to be taken together. Okay? So conceptually they're different, and you have to find out in which order you have to take them and how. And I also stress it because this classical approximation, as I already said, at the discrete level, at the level of individual spin forms, is reasonably well understood. And at the level of individual discrete gravity path integrals. The problem is the continuum of degrees of freedom, increasing the number of degrees of freedom, or refining the triangulations, call it as you like. All right, and the way to do this, we know it, especially if you have a field theory at your hands, is the renormalization group. That's the way to keep control over more and more degrees of freedom and their interactions. So you expect, in general, to be in need of renormalizing your microscopic models and to unravel what is their phase structure and whether there are phase transitions, again, because you're looking for at least one phase in which a geometric approximation is possible. And there is a lot of work in all the related formalism that I mentioned to group field theory, but of course I will focus now on the group field theory work. So the main strategy we are adopting is to be as naive as possible, in the sense that I gave you a field theory. We know how to renormalize a field theory. By being naive, in this sense, we are able to really make use of the powerful tools that come from a generic quantum field theory formalism. The way we are going to stop being naive and trying to be smart is to reinterpret the standard procedure from quantum field theory in quantum geometric, quantum gravity terms. Here it means that we are dealing with group field theories as almost ordinary quantum field theories on a group manifold. We use the group structures like the Killian form and so on to define a notional scale and what we mean by mode integration. So in particular, it means that a notional scale is indexed by group representations. Large representation parameters is UV. Small representation parameters is IR. And at least formally, we can just go along and define the randomization group in these terms. Problem, of course, is to control the theory space, so the space of possible interactions for any given model. And because the combinatorial structure is non-trivial, we have to adapt most of the notions of usual quantum field theory to this highly more complex combinatorial structures. In one word, we don't have just graphs, Feynman graphs, and we know what connected means, so we know what subgraph means, and so on and so on. We need to generalize this to cellular complexes, and it's some work. However, when we ask whether our models are consistent in this language, this means something very specific. The question, is your model consistent at the quantum level, becomes, is your model renormalizable as a quantum field theory? And so there's been a lot of work on proving to all, to the highest level of rigor that I can stand, whether these models are indeed renormalizable. And we have been growing complexity of the models, starting first abelian models without additional geometricity conditions, then with more conditions, then non-abelian, and so on and so on. And we are progressing in that direction. The final point being, we know a large number of renormalizable group field theories. For many of them, we can even establish asymptotic freedom or asymptotic safety, and so on. But the continuum limit has to do with somehow resumming the old Feynman diagrams, really encoding all possible degrees of freedom associated to triangulations. And that is non-perturbative renormalization. It means trying to make sense of the full path integral. There are several ways in which this can be done, and I've been involved in this one. So we try to adapt functional randomization group techniques to these field theories, again, trying to be naive. You have a field theory, you know what it means to have scales and modes separation. Write down the Wetterich equation for these models, introducing cutoff functions and so on, so on, usual formalism. Solving the resulting Wetterich equation for the effective action is implicitly solving the full path integral. In fact, a solution to that equation is a definition of the full continuum path integral. And it means studying fixed points in the UV, in the AR, have a picture of the phase diagram. Here again, we went on analyzing different models, although we're still really at the beginning. The first papers were from 2014. So we have explored a less rich variety of models. But what seems to be the case so far is that, first of all, you can do it. Second, you find UV fixed points, showing asymptotic freedom, at least for these models. And you find IR fixed points, that seem to be of this Wilson-Fisher type. And again, the indication, very tentative so far, because these are really toy models from the point of view of quantum geometry, is that there may be a symmetric phase and a condensate phase in which the field operator acquires a non-zero expectation value. This is interesting because it gives some support to the way we are trying to answer this question. The last question I'm going to put forward here is, what effective continuum physics can you extract from these models? I've said a lot about the discrete geometry, and I've said a lot about formal properties of the field theories, like randomizability. Where is gravitational dynamics? So what we are trying to do is to extract, first of all, cosmological dynamics from these models. So what we are trying to do is to bridge the gap between the microscopic description of space-time and the fundamental dynamics of these microscopic building blocks and some effective quantum gravity-inspired models for example, cosmology, like loop quantum cosmology or related. And of course, this is a particular sector of the more general problem of extracting gravitational dynamics for generic GR-like geometries from the fundamental theory. And there's been related work also on this problem. So, again, let me clarify the setup before I give you some results. It's clear that we're not interpreting the problem of quantum gravity as the problem of quantizing GR, maintaining those degrees of freedom. We're interpreting the problem as providing a microscopic theory of some quantum degrees of freedom, which are the fundamental degrees of freedom that give rise to geometry. Or if you want, what replaces the IR degrees of freedom of gravity in the UV. And that we are assuming that the gravitational field should be itself the result of the collective dynamics. So space-time and geometry are emergent entities from the point of view of the microscopic theory. In this light, cosmology is not the symmetry reduced, it cannot be a symmetry reduced sector of a quantum gravitational theory. It is rather the most coarse-grained description of the microscopic theory, where you only focus on large-scale coarse-grained observables. But it's a different process, it's not symmetry reduction. If cosmology arises from coarse-graining, in general, you would expect that you're going to get some effective theory for some statistical distribution over the microscopic degrees of freedom, rather than a quantum theory of homogeneous geometries, as it would be the case in a symmetry-reduced sector. More precisely, you look for some hydrodynamic approximation of the full theory. Okay, and this, I'll skip, is basically what I said. So you should expect that if cosmology is some sort of hydrodynamic approximation of the microscopic theory, just like in normal hydrodynamics in atomic systems, your basic variables at the end will be some form of fluid density, the arguments of which are going to be the geometric data of mini superspace, but it's going to satisfy some nonlinear dynamics. So cosmology will be some nonlinear effective dynamics for such fluid density. With, yeah.
What's mini superspace?
Mini superspace is a space of homogeneous geometries, homogeneous continuum geometries. So you impose spatial homogeneity, so you don't see any local structure. So you are only left with the global degrees of freedom. And this idea of neglecting local structure is the cosmological principle and is exactly the idea of coarse-graining up to the global observables. Okay, the problem is that the coarse-graining, both at the kinematical level and at the dynamical level, is very difficult. If I give an atomic system in condensed matter and I ask you to coarse-grain it up to the larger scales, unless you have a super good understanding of the general symmetries of the system, so you can just guess what is the effective macroscopic dynamics, it's hard to do it explicitly. One case in which it is a little bit easier is quantum condensates, Bose condensates. There is an almost direct path, at least in the simplest cases, from the microphysics to the macrophysics. And that's what we're following. It's a bunch of work from several people over the last 3 years, more or less. So the first problem is to identify quantum states in the fundamental theory which admit a good continuum space-time interpretation. But this space-time interpretation will have to be then substantiated by the effective dynamics. Otherwise, it's just, interpretation. Okay. And the main result is that, indeed, condensate states in the group field theory formalism admit this interpretation as continuum homogeneous spaces and geometries, where the continuum has to do with the fact that even the simplest condensate states can encode an infinite number of the microscopic degrees of freedom. They just encode them collectively in very simple dynamical observables. And the simplest example is a state constructed in the fundamental GFT Fock space like this. So you exponentiate this operator. This operator is just the convolution of the creation operator of the field theory with some wave function sigma. Because you exponentiate it, you can also expand it in series in n particle states. And you're going to sum over n particle states, so n actions of such creation operator on the Fock vacuum, with n going from 0 to infinity. So this state is actually a superposition of spin network states, if you want, with a number of nodes that go from 0 to infinity. But it's extremely simple, because these states just do not take into account the connectivity information between the nodes. They just tell you that you have n nodes with appropriate variables weighted by the same wave function sigma. In this sense, it is a condensate. All the particles are in the same state, exactly. This is the simplest, less realistic, actually, for real condensate, condensate states that you can write down. But a lot of physics, especially the hydrodynamic level in real condensates, is done here. Is done with this type of states. This is basically, from the point of view of the field theory, a mean field approximation in which you neglect fluctuations and you stick to the most global description. The nice point that allows you to interpret these states in geometric terms is that with appropriate conditions, the domain on which this wave function, which is a collective wave function for this infinity of degrees of freedom, depends, is isomorphic to the mini superspace of homogeneous geometries, which is exactly the type of continuum geometries you use to describe cosmology if you neglect the cosmological perturbations and fluctuations. So what you have is a collective variable that is a function on mini superspace. Okay, I'll skip this, and I can go back to that if you require. So it's more about the justification of this interpretation, but it was basically captured by the last statement I discussed. At the dynamical level, what you do is to just assume as an ansatz that your vacuum state for the theory is of that simple type, this simple condensate type, and you write down the Schwinger-Dyson equations, your fundamental quantum dynamics of the field theory, in terms of those states, in terms of this state. Then you approximate to the simplest Schwinger-Dyson equation, which basically gives you the classical equation of motion of whatever model you started from. So the statement is that you have a collective variable for this infinite number of degrees of freedom in this particularly simple state, which is this function sigma on a domain which is mini superspace, and you extract from the full dynamics in the simplest approximation a nonlinear equation, which is nothing else than the classical equation of the underlying field theory model. If you know about Bose condensates, this would be the Gross-Pitayski equation, hydrodynamic equation for the atoms. Okay, just the simplest form of the hydrodynamics of the condensate. Right. Okay, so there are a lot of results that have been obtained in the last 3 years, including by people in this room. Well, mainly by people in this room. There are a few exceptions. There are not many people, I have to say. But anyway, but still, they are very productive. I show you one particular recent result, which we are all quite excited about, because it's a template for extracting an effective cosmological dynamics that you can recognize and that you like, and sounds right, from the microscopic theory, starting from a model that we also sort of trust and like, which is the EPRL model. If you know about the EPRL model from spin forms. Anyway, we start from a model that is encoded in SU2 data, is based on SU2 data. We apply all the formalism that I told you about condensates and so on by doing these extra steps. First of all, we introduce an additional variable which has the interpretation of a free, massless, real scalar field. The interpretation comes about because if you write down a model with those kernels for fields with this additional variable, the discrete path integral that arises from this group field theory model has the right properties to encode discrete gravity coupled to a free, massless, real scalar field. So if you trusted the pure geometry part, you are forced to trust the coupled description. So in practice, you extend the number of variables of the fundamental GFT fields, you write down appropriate kernels, then you do some further approximation in which the field is slowly varying with respect to this additional variable, which makes sense in an hydrodynamic regime. Then you reduce to isotropic condensate configurations, which from the discrete geometry point of view basically means working with equilateral tetrahedra. So that the only variables you have is the total discrete volume of each building block and this scalar field variable. And so it means reducing from this collective wave function for the same type of condensate states to one that depends only on a single spin and on this additional real variable. You still with me? Nod? Enthusiasm? Excitement? I don't want to party with you. From the microscopic definition of the model, we extract along the ways I showed you in the previous slide an effective equation for this collective wave function, so defined and reduced. So it's a generically, again, a nonlinear equation, and the functions of J that enter here come from the specific kernels of the EPRL model in this isotropic restriction. The fact that you have a second derivative and not worse with respect to the scalar field comes with this assumption, which is an approximation on a more general behavior. Okay, so that's what you get from the microscopic theory. That's an hydrodynamic equation for the wave function associated to the fluid sigma. From this onwards, you can forget about the microscopic theory, except that you want to write down observables. And we have a notion of discrete volume for each of the tetrahedra in these models which have a good geometric interpretation at that discrete level, from which we can construct as expectation values in the condensate state an expression for the expectation value of the total volume that we can associate to the state. And it's basically just the weighted sum of the contribution from each of the quantum, of the quanta. And this is the expression. And we call rho the modulus of sigma. So this is really hydrodynamic type variables. The phase of the fluid and from which you can compute the velocity, and this is the density. And this m is just the ratio of the initial two functions that you had there. Okay, that's one observable, but you can do the same for the momentum of the scalar field at fixed time. Here, this is the crucial point, is that we introduce this real scalar field to play the role of a clock, as it's customary in, well, I would say in quantum gravity, but in specifically in quantum cosmology. And it plays the role of time. So we can define the volume at given time, the momentum of the scalar field at given time, and so on. And all these quantities are computed in the microscopic Fock space. Okay, just as the dynamics is extracted from the full theory, also the observables that you try to recast the dynamics in terms of are computed from the fundamental theory. And similarly for the energy density of the scalar field at fixed time is a known expression in terms of these two. And now you try to obtain from this equation for the fluid density, sigma, an equation that relates these variables so that you can give it a geometric interpretation in this continuum setting. And these are the equations. They are so beautiful that I would wait 10 minutes so that you can appreciate them. But unfortunately for all of us, we cannot. And so you will have to stare at them later. So these are the equations where prime means the derivative of the expectation value of the volume with respect to the clock, with respect to the real scalar field used as a time coordinate. The first thing you should notice is that if this is the equation, if these are the equations governing the dynamics of the volume stays positive at all times. It has a single turning point. Okay, this I didn't write, so it can go to a minimum and grows again with a single turning point. Oh, one thing that I forgot is that in extracting these equations, we assume that the interactions are subdominant. The nonlinear part in the equation for sigma is subdominant, which we can discuss, but it's sort of almost required for consistency, because the type of simple condensate states that we have used to derive the equation are neglecting the fluctuations and the correlations between the quanta that would be naturally generated by the nonlinear terms. So those terms cannot be too big. If they start becoming too big, maybe the resulting hydrodynamic approximation still works, but a priori you have no justification for it. And again, this is translating to this system what is known in BEC. Anyway, so there is a single turning point, and otherwise the volume stays positive. In other words, if you interpret these equations in cosmological terms, this is a quantum balance. And in fact, it's due to the quantum corrections to what would be a classical approximation to the system, to the same equations. Now, I want to emphasize that the regime in which this approximation holds and in which you get this simplified form of the equations is dynamically reached. It's not a further assumption on the class of states. For the generic condensate states satisfying these equations, there will be a regime that is more or less large volume, not exactly, but more or less large volume, in which this approximation holds and the equation simplifies to this. I can read in your eyes the question. Okay, so what? And the answer to that question is that when the equations are so simple, it's immediate to see that a sufficient condition for reading this right-hand side as the Friedmann equations is that the microscopic parameters are close to constant, so that this equation holds. Test to hold approximately, I've done this last slide, almost. Oh, yeah.
Can you say where the H bars are in the, for example, the first equation?
Yeah, I would have to. So there is an H bar.
Maybe where is the MI?
Oh, the MI I introduced it earlier is the ratio between these two functions that enter
what are they?
Sorry?
What are they?
I can give you the expression from the DPRL model. They are like some powers or functions of J. But here we are parameterizing a bit, because in the DPRL model, you can shift a little bit the dependence on J from the interaction to the kinetic part. So it's slightly more general parameterized form of an EPRL model. But here the purpose was try to be as general as possible with the right ingredients and put constraints on what those functions should be from the effective dynamics. And that's what we do in this extra slide. So through the dynamics, you reach this simplified form of the equations. And if those functions are approximately constant in this regime, then you have the Friedmann equation. Then you're going to have deviations and corrections, so that's fine, but you have the right building blocks. The other point is that if you consider now an approximation on the condensate states, that is, that the condensate wave function sees only one spin, so instead of having a superposition over spins, it basically sees only one, then the equation simplifies farther, and it becomes, in the full quantum equations, simplify farther to what is basically the LQC equation, if you know about it, plus an extra term that is state dependent, because this E, just like the Q here, are constants of motion that depend on the state.
Is it only the usual convert to the sum itself?
Sorry, say it again?
Is it a sum diverged by the ratio of the sum converged?
What diverges? No, this sum doesn't diverge. This sum is a sum, it's just that you have to give me what is your state, which is this rho here, this sigma j, and that will evaluate to something different, but it doesn't diverge. It's a spin, is what it is. What I'm saying is that if the state is such that this sum basically can be dropped because the state only sees one spin, and notice that this is basically the usual assumption in LQC, that you have cells which are all equal to each other with minimal area, and the old dynamics is the number of cells. This will be basically this approximation here. Then you get exactly the LQC dynamics up to this extra state-dependent term. Okay, and then it can even be shown that such simple condensate states are again approximated by generic solutions to the dynamics. So it's also they reach a regime in which this is true. And then Mary and students have also studied what happens when you don't assume that the interactions are subdominant, but you introduce them and they checked what happens to how they modify the dynamics. And it's nice because in principle you can have enough acceleration close to the bounds to avoid any need for an inflaton field. But again, this is a tentative for now, but still true. Okay, and the only last two questions, and then I really close this, is what's next? So I told you that there is a big bounce, there is a quantum bounce. So is this what happens to the cosmological singularity? So do we have a bounce? And the main advantage of what we did was to show that it is actually reproduced in the full theory, not just in an LQC-type toy model. Well, this is true, provided in that regime, the whole hydrodynamic approximation and the various other approximations we have done do not break down. And this is something that we have to check. It is also possible that you realize that in the regime of states and degrees of freedom that would be close to the would-be bounds, the hydrodynamic approximation breaks down because maybe you go closer to the regime where you have an underlying phase transition in the full quantum field theory. In which case, what you're going to have is not a bouncing scenario, but rather something like the emergent universe scenario of Brandenberger and colleagues. The nice point is that we can check. Because we have embedded this effective cosmological dynamics in the full theory under all the assumptions and approximations that I tried to explain, it can be done. So you can check what happens in that regime. And maybe it's not a bounce, but it's rather something more exotic happening close to the Big Bang, which I have really no way to represent. And then, okay, next point, which I'm not going to discuss, is how do we go about including cosmological perturbations? And I'm happy to discuss the possible strategies that came to our mind. And because I had to close with another nice picture, so there's still a long journey ahead, and if you are on drugs, it looks better. Thank you.
What's the relation between the renormalization story and the BEC story?
Well, at the moment, the only contact we have is the fact that for simpler models than those with all this quantum geometric content, and in the truncation where we were able to do analytically the FRG analysis, we see hints of a condensate phase. We see indeed the type of phase transition between a symmetric and a condensate or broken phase, where the simplest characterization in mean field of that phase would be that there is a non-zero expectation value of the field operator, like the ones on which we are building to construct the condensate, effective cosmology from condensates.
So one should use the effective action in that phase.
Is the classical action mean field means that in that phase you have an effective dynamics which is basically the classical action with around non-zero values of the field, and so that's exactly the type of dynamics we explored. The mismatch is the fact, first of all, that in this fundamental FRG analysis we dealt with very simple models so far, and second that also for those models we are at the simplest truncation. And we have to check that it's stable, all this phase diagram is stable under improvement of the truncation.
So when people play with analog models and Bose-Einstein condensate, some layers it's possible to get some cosmological constant that goes in there. Can you do that?
Yes.
Do you have a hope that without actually quantum loop or whatever, you get that from the
We have plenty of hopes. Now I tell you how we try to realize them. So one thing to do is that it could be that staying at this mean field level, but by modifying the microscopic model, and one way would be going to a quantum group, you read again the effective simplest cosmological dynamics, and there is an additional term, which is cosmological constant to some power of the volume, which is what you would expect with the cosmological constant in Friedman-type universes. So that's one way. Or there may be modifications on the quantum states, maybe slightly more complicated than the one we used, and again, you read out the effective dynamics, and there is a cosmological term. This is not what happens in analog gravity models. There, I mean, at least in one scheme that I know about, the was it from you? But anyway. One of them has to, I'm preaching to the converted. One way is to actually look at the depletion factor, so the particles outside of the condensate, which here would be captured by fluctuations over the condensate, so the quasi particles. Look at the global observables for those degrees of freedom out of the condensate, and they will modify the dynamics, and you check if there is an effective cosmological constant in the effective dynamics with that modification. That would be another way of doing it.
I don't have a constraint of what kind of valent vortex you can write on this theory, apart from the one simplex.
Look, I mean, the simplicial assumption is not crucial. It's just that only in that case I have a good control. So it's not crucial for the whole scheme of things. But it's only in that case they have a very good geometric understanding of the microscopic model. So I know exactly what the volume should be, how should I impose isotropy and all these type of things. But in itself, the scheme is really like, tell me what quanta you have, write down a condensate state of the simplest type, extract the effective dynamics. If you have a geometric interpretation for the microscopic data, you're going to have an effective geometric interpretation for the global observables. So that will stay the same.
So the effective dynamics you were writing were linear in sigma, right?
If you assume that the interactions are subdominant, yes.
Then there's no interaction there, so it doesn't matter which
Sometimes
the directions become, right?
But what I mean is that suppose that instead of one way to change the microscopic model is to change the valence. Another one would be to change the group or to impose different conditions on the fields. I'm saying that you can do anything you like, provided that you still have a good discrete geometry interpretation
of
the
quanta.
And then this would be
true. Comes from the geometry, comes from the structure of the vertex interaction, whereas the equation that you write down comes when you neglect. Equation, if I understand properly, I didn't see details, but the details of interactions are completely irrelevant.
Yeah, but they're relevant, as you said, for the interpretation. If there were just no interaction whatsoever, then I would just have no basis for interpreting the quanta in this geometric language in terms of discrete geometry. Then it's true. What we've shown is that the presence of the interactions, although important at the interpretation level, is not important for the effective dynamics. If you're interested in Friedman, it could well be that, you know, as soon as you switch on isotropies, anisotropies, for example, you're going to get the wrong equation unless you take into account the interactions. We just looked at a very tiny sector, and yes, the answer seemed to be that you get the right type of
what's
behavior.
The rationale then for,
sorry?
I mean, yeah, okay.
I'm not saying the interactions are not crucial for everything we got. They're crucial for having the interpretation.
They're crucial for the first part of your story. In the second part of the story, they're completely neglected.
Correct. In extracting the Friedman equation, they're not
needed.
In the
design of the model, this is where the gravity is, where we don't understand. There's a tension. I mean, it's interesting to look at, you know, the FFP, the linear dynamics, but somehow...
No, but first of all, we neglected it to obtain these equations. These ones. The interactions will give you this plus corrections on the volume. So it will still be true that you get the leading term being Friedman, but you're going to get different corrections. First. Second, you can include them, and that's what Mary and other people have done, and they do affect the dynamics of the volume, maintaining a Friedman-type regime, but they change the behavior close to the bounds, for example, and they may lead to recollapse. And so you get a cyclic type of universe. So they become relevant. They're simply not dominant, and so they don't prevent this to be valid in some regime of approximation. Think of it differently.
Well, maybe it's because I don't understand the lens, but the picture I have, or the original picture of this low-gravity model, is that you have some kind of propagation of individual tetrahedra. But if I was averaging just that, I would have infinite number of disconnected universes. And then you need a mixing term, which is the interaction that somehow make them grow.
Okay.
So
if
I neglect the interaction, I have a picture in mind where there's no reason to believe that I'm homogenizing anything
correct.
In that picture. So that's where I agree that it's very nice to look
No,
at
no, but when you take
but
that approximation, when you make this reasoning, you're making the approximation neglecting interactions somewhere else, not at this level. You're making the approximation neglecting the interaction in the very definition of the quantum theory for the individual quanta. For the microscopic theory. For example, I can well imagine that if the interactions were not there, I would just never reach a condensate phase. So the whole thing will just not be there, will not be relevant. So here there's no assumption that the interactions are not...
So the condensate should depend on the presence of the interaction. That's what I'm missing.
But it does depend in the sense that it gives corrections to this, and they become even relevant in some regime.
I don't know. Maybe we should check.
Think of it differently. Here, the assumption is that they are subdominant compared to the kinetic part. It's not that they are zero. So, and then we look at the dominant contribution, and that's what we get. If they were not subdominant, the old spin foam expansion would be meaningless from the GFT point of view. You will not be allowed to do any perturbative expansion. So, we better believe that they are subdominant, and nobody is claiming that they are zero. We are just saying that they are subdominant compared to this leading term. So they change the dynamics, but in a subdominant way. Of course, they become relevant in appropriate regimes of the fields, of the variables, of the observables, and so on. And in fact, that's what Mary has studied.
Yeah.
maybe more concretely, in this case, you said you started from Imperial.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, all the non-triviality of Imperial is in the in. So how do you...
No, first
maybe,
of all...
Okay, just to maybe this answer somehow also Laurent's question.
Sure.
Say how you're splitting things and what is relevant for those coefficients,
mm-hmm.
because if the vertex is completely...
So first of all, Imperial enters in several ways. Oh, let me make a general point. When I move from a spin form level to a GFT level, there is a certain ambiguity in what I call vertex and what I call kinetic term, because I can redefine fields and move ingredients from one point to the other. That's one other reason why we parameterize the kinetic part and this part. Okay, so this is slightly more general than a specific version of EPRL. Second, when you say EPRL, I'm forced to ask exactly with which weights, and that's a further reason why we would parameterize the various ingredients. Where it enters is the fact, for example, that both these functions and this function become functions of a single J in this equilateral restriction. More general models will not satisfy this, so will give a different effective dynamics already at that level.
Like the embedding in a cell to C?
It's implicit in the...
It's in the interaction. It's not appearing in the...
Well, you can write also the terms there. Well, first of all, you can write everything as L2C and,
sure.
and project.
This is not what is in here. I'm just trying to understand.
Well, at the end here, you wrote everything in SU2 variables.
Okay.
Whether you have done it here, here, and here, or only in some of them, doesn't matter. At the end, you just reduce everything to SU2 data, which you know how to interpret geometrically because there is the L2C, the simplicity, and so on and so on. More technically, you will not be able to reduce it to just a single spin in the isotropic restriction if it was not the EPRL or similar to EPRL. It is true that this term involves also the coupling constant, and we assume it's subdominant.
Mm-hmm.
And again, let me stress, if it was not subdominant, I would be no reason to take this model, because the only thing I know about the EPRL model has to do with what from the GFT point of view is the perturbative expansion. So they have to be subdominant. Then the question is, what is their effect? And here what we're doing is, okay, let's first extract the effect effective dynamics neglecting these corrections. They have to be corrections, but let's first neglect that, and that's what we know. That's what we get. And then we need to check, okay, if we now include the interactions, how is the dynamics of the volume coming from this modified? And this is what we started to do. But again, for example, from a more fundamental point of view, it may even be that if the interactions were vanishing, and not just the subdominant, you would just not have a condensation. So there's no claim here that the interactions are not crucial for the whole scheme. They just affect in a subdominant way the effective equation for the isotropic case.
Basic questions.
Previously,
you mentioned that
you have
asymptotic free models.
You have, sorry? Oh, yes. Some models are asymptotically free, others are asymptotically safe.
Oh, then for this model,
We don't know.
Okay. That was going to then at the low energy and the high energy.
Yes, but again, so the answer is I don't know, because we didn't study the randomization group flow of this specific class of models. But again, let me stress that the notion of UVIR has to do not with energy in spacetime. For example, it doesn't have to do with the energy corresponding to the scalar field. It has to do just with the notion of larger representation indices, smaller representation indices, which, as far as the flow of the field theory is concerned, is perfectly consistent because that's where the divergences are, so everything fits. But the geometric interpretation, one has to be very careful with it.
It's not technical. It's at the level of the some being interpreted as some over triangulations.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know if really you are summing over things that can be thought of as the collection of all the manifolds that they were talking about yesterday, or not?
So if we color the model, so if
is
you would...
Is this color already? Or?
No, DPL as we use it here, we don't color it because we don't use the color information anyway in the effective dynamics. It would be, if you want, a sector of the colored model in which the different fields behave similarly. And so they behave just like one uncolored field. But with the colors, then you know that you're summing over colored, D plus one colored graphs, which each can be put in one-to-one correspondence with a piecewise linear manifold with the conical singularities a priori, but nothing worse than that.
Any last question? All right, let's thank the audience.